sermons for March 2nd, lesson 256, and then you can click that link and open the notes and follow along with us here as we go through this material. Okay, so as always, we've got a lot of ground to cover, so I want to get right into things this morning. So, lesson 256, assessing the printed history of the King James text, Blaney and the 1769 Oxford text. Let me just say, I said last week at the end that we were going to be talking about italics. I lied. We got more to talk about on Blaney before we talk about italics. Okay. Now, when I said that, I started. I've got 9 pages done already on italics. But then I'm like, yeah, wait a minute, I left some stuff out. So, okay. I don't intentionally lie about stuff like that. Things just happen. Okay. What can I say? All right. Introduction. Lessons 253, 254, and 255 were devoted to covering the editorial work of Benjamin Blaney that Benjamin Blaney conducted for Oxford University Press in preparation for the 1769 edition of the Authorized Version. All told, we have considered the following categories of revision conducted by Blaney. So, we've looked at changes to the number of a noun in Lesson 254, changes in verb, tense, and usage, also Lesson 254, restoration of 1611 readings, 254, correction of printer's errors, Lesson 254, and then last week, Lesson 255, we looked at word changes, modern forms, and idioms. We looked at changes in the use of definite articles. And then last, we looked at apostrophes and possessive forms. Okay, so we've been at this now for a number of weeks regarding Blaney's work. So look at the next point. Since teaching Lessons 254 and 255, my friend and fellow researcher, Christopher Yetzer, that's the brother who's a missionary in Italy, okay, has shared additional data regarding some of the revisions ascribed to Blaney by David Norton and Gordon Campbell. As we observed with the work of F.S. Paris in Lessons 250 through 252, there is evidence, Mike, before I forget, oh, never mind, forget it, sorry. As we observed with the work of F.S. Paris in Lessons 250 through 252, there is evidence that many of the changes accredited to Blaney had been made in earlier editions, in lesser editions, smaller size, prior to 1769. So let's stop there. You remember how we looked at Paris and then we saw how there were changes that had been made that Norton and Campbell ascribed to Paris that had actually been made before Paris. All right. Now what we're going to look at here to start the hour is that the same phenomenon occurs when we consider the work of Benjamin Blaney for Oxford University in 1769, okay? Over the last couple of weeks, I have backfilled the notes from Lessons 254 and 255 to include these details provided by Brother Yetzer. So what I did is as he gave me information and we looked at it, I backfilled it into the notes from the last 2 weeks, okay? The reason I did that was so that when eventually I get around to printing those lessons, the material is there in the correct spot. Okay? So, in this lesson, the one we're going to do right now, I would like to bring the class up to speed regarding this information and offer a brief analysis of the data before commencing a discussion of the use of italics in the AV. So therefore, we will be covering the following 2 points in this lesson. Point one is going to be additional information and data, and point two is going to be changes in you and ye in the work of Blaney. Okay? So does anybody have any questions about the introduction? Okay, so bottom of page one. The table below contains all of the examples of revisions ascribed to Benjamin Blaney in 1769 by Gordon Campbell in Bible, The Story of the King James Version, 1611 to 2011, and David Norton in A Textual History of the King James Bible. Okay? So the table has all of the changes that Blaney made that were ascribed to Blaney by Norton and Campbell. All right? We'll get to the top of page 2. Please note that only those examples discussed by Norton in the main text of his book have been discussed in, I need to work on that sentence. I don't like it, Mike. The sentence starting, please note, okay? Please note that only those examples discussed by Norton in the main text of his book in Lessons 254 and 255. While it might be possible to furnish additional examples from Appendix 8 in Norton, For the purposes of this class, I have limited myself to only those examples that are discussed in the main body of the text. Okay? So, I'm only talking about the ones that Nort brings up in the main body of his text. If you go to the end of the book, there's a massive appendix, Appendix 8, that catalogs basically every change that he observed as he looked at things. Okay? So, moreover, I have not included the examples of apostrophes and possessive forms discussed in Lesson 255 because this grammatical convention did not come into use in English until the 1700s. Therefore, there was no reason to check the editions of the 1600s for evidence of the use of apostrophes to denote possessive forms in English. No reason to look at it because they weren't being used at that time frame, so I did not include them in the data that we're about to look at. Okay? Lastly, the table lists the verses in question in canonical order. So let's make sure we understand what that means. So if you look at the table here, I have the verses listed in canonical order, the order they appear in the canon of Scripture. Okay? Look at the next bit there. Canonical order records. The table records the revision that was made to the text. So that's this category right here, the revision that was made, the second column there, all right? Revision that was made to the text by Blaney. Notes the category or type of change. That's this column right here, category/type. So, for example, for changing a number of a noun in the table, I just say number of a noun with an abbreviation for the word number, okay? Let me see here. The lesson in which the example was originally discussed. So you can see the lesson column. Lesson 254, eventually we'll see some 255, so I included that information in there, okay? And lists known editions before 1769 that made the change before Blaine. Okay? So does everybody understand how the table is structured? Alright? So let's pass through this. Alright? So, we'll do maybe a few of these so that you get the sense. But if we looked at every single one of these, it would take too long. So maybe we'll look at 5 to 10. All right? So let's look at the first one. We're talking about Exodus 23:13. Here's the revision. Names of other gods is changed to name of other gods. That's a change in the number of a noun. We discussed that in Lesson 254. And these are all of the earlier, here's evidence of earlier changes made to that verse before 1769. So that change appears in a 1756, a 1765, a 1767, and a 1768 before the change is made by Blaney in 1769. Okay? So, here's another example of Norton and Campbell. They only look at the folio editions. Alright? Notice what these are. Octavo. These are lesser sized editions. Notice we have Cambridge, Oxford. Have already made the change to from names of other gods to name of what? Other gods. Before Blaney in 1769. But in their books, Gordon Campbell and David Norton ascribe that change right there, that revision, to the work of Blaney, but there's historical evidence to suggest that it actually occurred before who? Now, in the digital copy of the notes, I'm just going to click on one of these, okay? So we're going to click on 1756 Cambridge. You will notice that it will load the viewer, and it should open to the page. And what's this verse again? 23:13. See if I can make that bigger. And there we have the change to name of what? Other gods. In a 1756 Cambridge that predates who? Blaine. Okay? So, going sort of in depth there on the first example, does everybody understand? Let me go back to the table. So if you have the digital copy of the notes, you can click on all these links and you can look at these entries for yourself and see that these changes were made to the text before Benjamin Blaney edited it in 1769. And that would go for all the blue links here in this entire table. Okay?
What about linking to?
They are linking to digitized copies on archive.com. So if you click on the one like we just did from 1756, it'll take you to this Cambridge 1756. If you click on the 1765 Cambridge Octavo, it'll take you to that edition. And I have to give props and credit to Alex Boyko for helping me. And this is a combined effort of Christopher Yetzer, who found the stuff and sent the links, Alex Boyko, who looked up in the Herbert catalog which edition numbers and catalog numbers we're looking at with each one of these, and then I took all of that and compiled it into the document that you're looking at. Okay, so this is a combined effort of myself, Christopher Yetzer, and Alex Boyko. Okay, now let's just look at maybe a handful more. All right, now here's one. Let's look at one. Leviticus 13:29. Half a plague is changed to have a plague. The nature of that change is a change in verb tense. We discussed that in lesson 254. And at this time, we can find no evidence of that change occurring before Blaney's 1769 edition. That is what the blank means in the table. Is everybody following this? Okay. Let's go to an example from lesson 252. Here's a couple from lesson 252. We talked about Deuteronomy chapter 20, verse 7. Die in battle is changed to die in the battle. That's a change in the definite article. We discussed that in lesson 255, and there's no known evidence at this time of that change having been made before Blaney in 1769. All right? A third example would be this one right here, 2 Chronicles 16:6. We talked about this one last week. Was a building is changed to was building. The nature of the change is a change in word slash idiom. We looked at this in lesson 255. And notice here, we can go all the way back and see this change occurring in a London quarto from 1661, well over 100 years before Blaney did anything and was probably even alive. Okay? So here we see it again, an example. So again, you can click that link. It's going to load the viewer page. And if we look at, we can zoom in. Here it is. Was building. What's missing?
A.
A. This is a 1661 London Bible. So there's evidence of that change being made as far back as 1661 to that verse. Okay? And again, that was not discussed by Campbell and Norton, simply because they did not look at all those editions. And then there's another example of that change in 1676. Okay? Now some of these, look at this one here, Psalm 99:2, all people to all the people, changing the definite article. We discussed it in lesson 255. You can go all the way back and see this change occurring in a 1635 Cambridge quarto. So again, these are all changes that are ascribed to Blaney in 1769 by Campbell and Norton, and when we look at these, do we find that for quite a few of these, there's evidence of the change being made way before 1769. So, guys, you have to understand, what we're going through right now is not covered by Campbell, it's not covered by David Norton, and it's also not covered in the newest book that's been released on this, The Text of the King James Bible by Lawrence M. Vance. Okay? All three of those brethren, all three of those gentlemen, they limited themselves to the folio editions, and they did not look at all of the lesser editions. Alright? Again, I'm not faulting them for that, because the immense amount of work that went into all of this is beneficial to the body of Christ, even if they missed certain things. Right? And let me just be honest, I am missing things. Am I not? I am. And without the help of Christopher Yetzer and Alex Boyko and others, this class would be minus the information that I'm even in the act of presenting to you right now. So I don't fault them for that. I'm just saying that the real story isn't even captured in these three fairly significant works that most people are aware of. Okay? Now, is everybody pretty much clear, without going through every example, of what the data in this table is showing? Does anybody have any comments or questions about that before we move on? I'm taking the silence to be a no.
The publisher, what? You got the folio folio size and then you got these other sizes, and is it like the same publisher in each of them, or?
No.
Why are the differences between the folios and the other sizes?
The folios usually came first, and then...
The folios were normally done first in a given year. So, and then the lesser sizes were done. So, if we, let's just take this example again of Psalm 99.2, okay? So, notice this is a 1635 Cambridge quarto. So, the change from all people to all the people is made by Cambridge in that edition. Okay? Cambridge also prints octavos. They print other things, and maybe that change wasn't in those, right? So, the reason, part of the reason is each one of these sizes has to be typeset independently. So imagine you have an octavo, you have a quarto, you have a duodecimo, all of them have to be typeset individually because of the size of the Bible. And then a folio as well, okay? So in this particular one, you've got 1635, 1679, 1638, and 1683, where you have the changes. So notice this London duodecimo and this London octavo, they make the change. But there's probably a bunch of other London duodecimos and octavos that are printed.
No.
Obviously not. Because these changes in the table, the scholars that looked at this said these changes didn't enter the text until Blaney. But now we're finding out that that's not even true. Because is there evidence of these changes having been made before, you know, in the way it was back here? For each edition and for each size. Okay. These different people were. They're unknown to us in history. All right. We know who. Now, what I want to do is something I haven't done in a while, and I want to jump out of the notes, and I want to jump into this video. Okay. This is a video that was sent to me. This is... put online on YouTube by somebody called Old School Bible Baptist. And there's some claims that are made in this video that I want you to consider the claims on before we move on any further in the notes and compare the claims that this guy makes in the video to what we've actually seen in this class. Okay? I think this is going to work. I queued this up beforehand. I tested it. It worked. Knock on wood. As a pagan, superstitious Gentile, that it'll work. Okay? Here we go. That was a joke. You guys can laugh at that, okay?
And that's why there were subsequent editions of the King James Bible, leading all the way up to the one that we use now, the 1769, and that's what your Oxford or your Cambridge is the 1769 edition of the 1611 King James Bible. But any edition of the King James Bible is a 1611 King James Bible because no words have been purposely changed from what the translators came out.
No words have been purposely changed. You just heard him make the claim. Is that true?
No.
Not from the evidence we've looked at in this class, that's not true. Okay, now we'll watch a little bit more.
Translation with in 1611. Nobody's ever purposely changed these words. Spelling has been updated. Printers, errors were corrected. But nobody has ever gone into here and intentionally changed any word in the Bible and try to correct what the translators came out of the their handwritten manuscripts, what the translators came out of the translation committee with, every single bit of work that has been done on any edition of the King James Bible by Oxford or Cambridge, the attitude, the mission, the theme has been to be true word for word to the translation. And that's obviously 108.
Is that true? Did later editors change things in the text?
think there's still truth to the translators.
So it's, I agree, they're true to the translators, but to say that it's exactly the same word for word, the same way it came from the translators, is not possible. The other thing is, he said, he equivocated slightly. How did,
said he didn't purposely change.
Yeah.
So they only corrected printer errors, but if there are changes, which you've demonstrated there are changes through the various editions, then his statement that none of them were on purpose, it leaves me a little confused as to how we got the changes then. Because again, if we're going to say that this is the inspired and perfectly preserved Word of God, and there are clearly changes, but none of them were on purpose, well then how did they get there, and do we have the perfect Word of God?
So in other words, he's saying they could be accidental.
Yeah, I mean, they would have to be. If so, none of them were on purpose, they would have to be accidental.
Right. So I agree with what Mike's saying. I think these people that edited were trying to be true to the translators. But it's not an accurate statement to say that what you have today is word for word the same as what, you know, what came off the press in 1611. Okay? Now, I'm going to walk maybe another 1 minute on this because he's going to say something else that I want to evaluate with you.
It's different motivation, heart attitude than every single other faith Bible, especially and including the New King James. They have gone in and purposely changed thousands of words. So, first half of my Christian life, I rocked this bad old boy right here.
Yeah, yeah.
And this was a...
We can stop that. But, so... There's a couple assertions that are made there. If you watch a little bit further, he's taken paper and he says the handwritten manuscripts of the translators are perfect. Okay? So I have two questions. Well, one question and then a comment. First of all, nobody knows in what form the translators submitted their work to the printer. Okay? He's theorizing that they wrote it all by what? By hand. Okay? But these handwritten copies of the translators, they're perfect. Handwritten. Handed to the printer, and now the printer makes errors. So if God's capable of making sure that using the schema that guy's arguing for, if God's capable of making sure the handwritten thing is perfect, would he not be capable of making sure that the printed thing is perfect if that's how God is operating in this scenario? You would think that, why would the one be too difficult? Because they talk about how, well, they had to spell everything backwards and they had to type set. Yeah, that's all true to lay out the type for it to be printed, okay? But if the handwritten manuscripts of the translators could be perfect, then why can't God oversee a perfect printing by that same definition and argumentation?
So, what were the later editors using to correct the errors if they didn't have the handwritten notes anymore?
In
his view, what would he have to say at this point? Because
I don't know in his view.
The handwritten notes are perfect, so that's what we would have to compare to see if there was a mistake made.
Right.
And nobody had those by the time you get to Blaney.
Right. Most people say that there's a lot of theorizing that can't be proved that it was all destroyed in the Great Fire of London in like 1666.
Sure.
So let's say that's true.
Well, yeah, but nobody's referencing it when they do their editorial work later. So Blaney's not saying, hey, I'm sitting down with the actual handwritten notes.
Correct.
From the translators, and I'm comparing what we have today to that, and I'm correcting what the printer messed up.
So Blaney is comparing the English to the Hebrew and the Greek, and he's thinking about it from the point of an English editorial approach to the text. But he is not taking refuge back to the handwritten manuscripts of the translators. He could take refuge back to the first printing of the 1611 and include that in his analysis. Okay.
What about the E one?
The first part of the video, when I'm watching it, I was confused because it kind of sounded like he was talking about the meaning.
he ultimately has to take, he ultimately, we could watch another video by this guy. Well, it's later on in this video about Oxford and Cambridge. He ultimately says, if you look at the differences between Oxford and Cambridge that exist today, he basically says none of these are of any practical consequence. They're all, he doesn't use the word, but they're verbally equivalent. Which is the same thing that I'm saying in my co-authored book with David Reed. Okay? So, that's, the video is just a snapshot of the kind of argumentation and the stuff that people say within the pro-King James space. And I brought it up and I showed it to you to make the point. The argumentation is just simply not true. I think Mike's right in identifying that the editors are trying to do this in the spirit of the translators, but they are making word choices and they are changing words, they are adding words, they are in some cases subtracting words, they are changing word structures, sentence structures. I've shown examples of all these different things on the YouTube channel, if not in this class. Okay? So, notice what we've got here. Okay? It says, careful readers will note that there are 20, so I'm on the page 4 under the table. Okay? Careful readers will note that there are 22 verse entries in the table above. Of the 22 entries, 10 of them, or 45.5%, contain evidence of having been revised before the editorial work of Blaney in 1769. So there's 22 entries in the table. There's, I don't want to get the numbers wrong. 10 of them have been revised. 45.5% of them have been revised before Blaney. Yet North and Campbell ascribe the editorial change in these 10 cases to Blaney when there's evidence that it actually occurred in some cases well over 100 years before who? Before Blaney. Okay? So, again, this proves yet again that the true history of the text is not limited to the flagship folios of 1629, 1638, 1762, and 1769. Important editorial work was occurring in an uneven manner in the lesser editions throughout the 17th and 18th centuries. Our conclusions regarding the editorial work of F.S. Paris from Lesson 250 are once again pertinent here. Number one, ascribing the precise date of origin for a given reading in the printed history of the King James text is a cautionary tale unless one has looked at every edition ever printed. Is that not even more true now after looking at the same phenomenon with Blaney? Okay. Number two, the work of Campbell, Norton, and Lawrence M. Vance, Textual History of the King James Bible, 2025, while extremely helpful and beneficial, are not definitive and need to be checked against other printings. So these are helpful books. They advance the ball significantly as far as understanding goes, but even those are not exhaustive. Okay? Number three, the printed history of the King James text is not as neat and tidy as many would like it to be. In the clip we just watched, that guy is presenting a very uniform, neat and tidy situation where it's just printer errors and the correction of certain things and spelling, and that's all that's going on. Okay? The printed history of the King James text is not as neat and tidy as many would like it to be. The text was never printed with uniformity between 1611 and 1769. Editorial changes were made to the text despite claims of some to the contrary. This is why demanding verbatim identicality of wording as a standard for preservation is an unhelpful standard and logically leads to one having to declare which edition printed everything perfectly to the exclusion of all others. Four. It is not correct to think of the history of the text in terms of four monolithic revisions occurring in 1629, 1638, 1762, and 1769. The real story unfolds year by year, printing by printing. Therefore, statements such as the following are grossly incorrect. And I'm on the bottom of page 4. The first two revisions of the King James Bible occurred within 27 years of the original Oxford printing. The original printing occurred in London, not Oxford. The 1629 and 1638 editions, both printed at Cambridge, focused on the correction of printing errors. Two of the original translators worked on the 1629 edition. There's no extant historical evidence that corroborates that statement, okay? The other two revisions of 1762 and 1769 focused more on the standardization of spelling. A case could be made that there were two editions instead of four revisions, because the first two and the last two were done close together and were stages of the same process. No, that case cannot be made because that case is not factually accurate. You can make the case all you want till the cows come home, but you're not going to change the actual facts on the ground. Okay? So before we move on to changes in U and E, does anybody have any comments or questions about the first point? No? Okay. I hear a lot of kicks and giggles going on, but...
No, it's like your source there.
Okay. So if there's no questions, let's go to point two then. We get going to point two. Okay? Changes in U and Ye. In lesson 252, we talked extensively about the U Ye changes implemented by F.S. Paris in his editions. In that lesson, we covered, number one, the grammatical rules governing the use of you and ye in English and how they changed over the centuries. Number two, statements from the pens of Gordon Campbell and David Norton regarding the changes made to you and ye by Paris and Blaney. Three, a statistical analysis of the findings cataloged in Chapter 3 of Lawrence M. Vance's book, The Text of the King James Bible, titled Editions of the Authorized Version. And four, we looked at three case studies of U Ye changes in Deuteronomy 18:5. Genesis 18:5.
9:4.
Why are those not? Okay, those are in the order we looked at them. It threw me off for a second because they're not in their canonical order. But we looked at Genesis 18:5 first, then we looked at 9:4, and then third we looked at Deuteronomy 1:13. Okay. So. That's what we said about UE changes when we looked at the work of Paris. Right? Regarding Blaney's changes to the use of you and ye, Campbell writes the following in Bible, the Story of the King James Version, 1611 to 2011. This is all he says, this one sentence. On you and ye, Blaney fully implemented the principle that Paris had started to implement. Period. End of his discussion. So, all Campbell says is that what Paris sought to implement in 1762, he didn't succeed in fully implementing it, and so Blaney takes that principle up in his editorial work, and he sort of finishes what Blaney had what Paris had started with the UE changes, etc. Okay? Any questions there? As usual, Norton offers a more exhaustive treatment of the topic. What follows is a lengthy citation from Norton regarding the changes made to the use of you and ye by Paris and Blaney. While I have included the entire quotation, we will focus primarily on what Dr. Norton says about Blaney, seeing that we have already discussed his comments about Paris in Lesson 252. Please note that I have annotated the citation by inserting screenshots of the examples discussed by Norton, as well as a few explanatory statements in brackets. Okay? So if you look at the bottom of page 5, we already read that and covered that when we looked at Paris. Go to page 6. On page 6, there's a discussion. We've already read this. Go drop down to this section right here, okay, in the time of Blaney and Paris. In the time of Blaney and Paris, the mid-18th century, the replacement of ye by you was still more a matter of usage than grammatical prescription. So Johnson, that would be Samuel Johnson in his famous dictionary and grammar. So Johnson, as a grammarian, gives ye as the nominative and you as the oblique form. So remember we talked about the technicalities of the grammar back in Lesson 252. I'm not going to go through all of that again here. Okay, but as a lexicographer, he notes that you is used in the nominative, and though first person introduced by corruption is now established. So what he's talking about there is, remember what we saw. In the 1600s, you, ye, your were always plural. Thee, thou, thine were always what? Singular. By the time you get into the middle of the 1700s, had you begun to come into usage to refer to a singular? And I showed you that in the changes of the tables back in Lesson 252. Robert Loaf, in his short introduction to English grammar, 1762, is less old-fashioned. He gives ye or you for the nominative, but dismisses instances of ye in other cases as improper or ungrammatical, even as manifest solecisms. That's from page 22 of his book. In these circumstances, Paris and Blaney had three choices. Okay, so let's back up. So in the 1611s, and the King James translators uniformly follow the same rule throughout for the use of you and ye. The answer to that is no, and we discussed that in detail in lesson 252. You with me? Some of you guys are not sure. You're like, no, I don't remember that. Well, go back and watch lesson 252. It's there, I promise. So in these circumstances, Paris and Blaney had three choices. One, they could, following the standard articulated by Loth, keep all the original usages of you and correct the dozen wrong uses of using ye for the nominative and you for other cases. Or three, they could follow the now established usage and give you throughout. So they have two choices they could make, right? Now this is where they're doing editing. There is no way around this. Are they changing the UE usage of the translators? If your head yes, okay. So notice what Norton says next. Each choice was grammatically defensible. The first would allow inconsistent usage, but be largely true to the original. The second would be unimpeachable, but old-fashioned. The third would begin to change the general linguistic character of the text. Might not thee and thou be replaced with you? And if that change is made, might not the old-fashioned endings be eliminated? So in other words, if they take out established usage and give you throughout, if they do that, now are they threatening the thee, thou, thine construction? So they don't take up three, because that would mean more changes are going to have to be what? Made. Is everybody following what Norton's saying here? Okay? So, by this time, the language of the King James Bible had become what John calls, quote, solemn language. It was the accepted language of the Bible and religion, distinguished from ordinary language, so such changes would probably have been unacceptable. So, do Paris and Blaney know that the language of the King James Bible is viewed by the English-speaking world as a solemn language? It's a known thing, by the time you get to the middle of the 1700s, that the language of the King James Bible is not the same as the language of the common man in the street, even by that point. Okay? So they're not endeavoring to be radical in their editorial work, but they definitely need to address some of this usage. Now, before we go on, does anybody have any questions there? You good, Mike? You look like you might have had a question or a comment.
So thee and thou are more biblically accepted.
Yeah.
Rather than the common language.
Yes. Thee, thou, thine are King James language for first person singular.
So
or singular.
Solemn language.
So that's what Johnson's calling solemn language. Biblical English, other people might call it. Which is not exactly the same as the conventions of the people in the street. Okay? Paris seems to have chosen the second option. So he's choosing, according to Norton, the second option. Go back and look at option two. Go back and look at option two. They could make the text consistent according to the translator's predominant usage, using ye for the nominative and you for other cases. So according to Norton, he's saying that Paris chose the second option. Okay? Now notice, Paris seems to have bottom of the page, page six, Paris seems to have chosen the second option, but then to have had doubts or became careless. After Genesis, where he made 14 of the 17 necessary changes, he usually, but not always, left what he found as he found it. It was Blaney who carried out the second option with admirable thoroughness. So there's the point that Blaney picks up where Paris left off, right? That this was a conscious move towards making the King James Bible speak uniformly solemn language fits with his replacement of the modern with the archaic verb forms in the Apocrypha. Okay? So, let's look at some examples. So this is where he starts talking about some specific examples. Okay? Very occasionally, Blaney misses. So sometimes he missed a couple, according to Norton's analysis. Very occasionally, Blaney misses an example or makes a mistake. You were inferior, for ye were inferior, in 2 Corinthians chapter 12, verse 13, looks like a plain mistake. So notice, 1611, for what was it wherein ye were inferior? Okay? 1769, for what was it wherein you were what? So does he change a ye to a you?
Yes.
Sure. He absolutely does. What Norton is saying is that based upon the technicality of grammar, that he probably should have left that one what?
Alone.
He should have probably left that one alone. So look at my bracket that I added here. Okay? In the case of 2 Corinthians 12:13, Norton is saying that Blaney made a mistake in the implementation of the editorial principle. Now let me ask you a question. You and ye, are they both plural? In the language of the King James type of language, are they both plural? Shake your head yes. You, ye, your are what?
Plural.
Plural. Is everybody following that? So does he make a change? So let me ask you a question. In light of what that video we watched a minute ago, is this a typo? Is this a printer error?
I think it's a typo because it's got two E's.
That's the way you could spell it that way back then. Is this a word change?
Yes.
It's a word change. Is it done in the spirit of what the translators are trying to get at? Sure. But is it a word change?
Yeah.
It's not word for word.
It's not word for word. And was it intentional or accidental?
Intentional.
Okay. Moving on, he brings up, and you, be ye fruitful, escapes him. Now look at this. Okay, so here's a 16:11. This is Genesis 9:7. And you, be ye fruitful. He changes it to what? Well, he leaves it alone. You be ye. I've read this wrong, I apologize. The first one. And you be ye fruitful. And you be ye fruitful. Does it sound somewhat awkward to have it say you ye and not have them both be what?
You.
The same, yeah.
I think that comes down to it.
Okay.
They don't want to have the same.
So there he leaves it alone.
you
so though he does where am I at? Bottom page 7. Though he does change the other example of this construction, and you in any wise keep yourselves to and ye. And this is in Joshua 6:8. Go to page 8. Here's the line of folio. Notice, and you. And then he changes that in 1769 to what? Ye. Okay? Then Norton says, erroneously he changes, I speak with tongues more than you all, 1 Corinthians 14:18, to more than ye all, as if ye all speak was implied, the Greek is genitive. So that's a technicality of the language, but you can see this change here. Here's the verse. This is what? What verse is this? 1 Corinthians 14:18. Notice the end of the verse, more than you all in the 16:11. And he changes it to more than what?
Ye
all. Is that a change? Is that a word change? Now, I'm going to argue it's not substantive because both of them are what? Plural. So why is he talking about this? He's talking about it because, according to the grammatical rules of the structure that these guys are implementing, are there a couple cases where they either forgot to do some or they left a few inconsistent. This is what Norton is getting at. Okay? He says at the bottom of page 8, sometimes his work seems to produce problems where imperatives are used. Go ye, get you straw where you can find it, Exodus 5:11. Looks as if it should have ye each time, but Blaney changes only you can, leaving the apparently inconsistent go ye, get you. He is right, both verbs are imperative, but the second is followed by literally get to you. So let's look at that. So here's 16:11. Notice, go ye, get you straw where you can find it. Is everybody seeing this on page 8?
Nine.
My bad. Getting ahead of myself. So, go ye, get you, straw, where you. So I've got three things underlined here. Ye, you, and what? You. So notice what he does, Blaney does in 1769. Go ye, get you, straw, where ye. So what Norton is getting at is that probably that should have also been a what? Probably this you right here also should have been what? A ye, if you are looking for a strict adherence to the grammatical rules that are dictating these changes. But leaving it this way, is it changing anything about the substantive doctrinal content of that verse?
No.
No. Alright? Representative of larger apparent inconsistencies, the first edition has prepare you three times and prepare ye six times. So I have the footnote there in brackets for footnote number 22. So prepare you appears in Joshua 1:11, Isaiah 62:10, 1 Ezra 4:1. Prepare ye in Isaiah 40 verse 3, Jeremiah 6:4, Baruch 1:10, Matthew 3:3, Mark 1:3, and Luke 3:4. Okay? He goes on to say, Blaney leaves prepare you victuals. How do you say that? Victuals? In Joshua 1:11, untouched, because the Hebrew has the word for you, so let's look at that. So here's the London folio, and notice, prepare who?
You.
Alright, go to page 10. Here's another one that he left alone. Prepare who?
You.
Victuals. Okay? But he changes. Prepare ye prepare you the way of the people, Isaiah 62 verse 10, to prepare ye, because the verb is imperative. Okay? So here's the other case. Notice prepare you, and this time he changes it to prepare who?
Ye.
Okay?
Let me back up. I think go ye get you straw. I would put go ye get your straw.
Okay.
I mean, to make it sound more English.
Well, that's the way we would say it now, maybe.
Yeah.
So, let's look at the last bit of this.
Yeah.
Get you all straw.
That's how we call it. Y'all. That sounds like that.
Yeah, that's better.
Y'all. Put that in there. That's biblical English. All right. Joking aside. Like many an editor and translator, he nods in the Apocrypha, leaving prepare you after your families in 1 Ezra 1:4. So, is Norton not admitting that people didn't really pay as much attention to the Apocrypha and all the stuff that they did to the canonical text? Interesting observation, given some of the claims being made right now on YouTube. The instances of prepare ye are unproblematic. This, therefore, is what has happened. The first edition's normal practice was to use ye with the imperative, except where something in the original, usually the Hebrew word for you, dictates using you as the direct object. Blaney has changed this practice into a rule with the result that the text still looks inconsistent, but is fully defensible in light of the originals. It is very rare to find a slip such as 1 Ezra 1:4. So what does that tell you? That tells you that his principle is he's comparing the English text with the original language text to make his determination to standardize the principle. Is everybody following that? Okay. I got 10 minutes. And we might make this, we might not. Okay. Bottom of page 10. I can cut some of this short. Chapter 3 of Lawrence M. Vance's book, The Text of the King James Bible 2025, is titled Editions of the Authorized Version. In this chapter, Dr. Vance catalogs changes made to the AV across all the major folio editions, 1629, 1638, 1762, and 1769, spanning pages 181 to 199. Mike, make a note that I need to check those page numbers because now I have the full copy of Vance. I was working off the fascicle page numbering when I originally wrote that. Okay? The rest of this is still the same. Vance notes 204 changes to the use of you and ye in the canonical text of the King James Bible. Consider the following breakdown of these changes by year and number. Now, we already looked at this once, okay? Top page 11. So, in 1629, there are seven changes to the use of you and ye. That's 3.4% of the 204, okay? In 1638, there are four changes made in the use of you and ye. That's 1.6% of the 204 changes, okay? 1762, there are 132 changes to the use of you and ye. That's 64.7% of the 204 changes cataloged by Vance. And in 1769, there are 61 changes in the use of you and ye, 29.9% of the total of 204. Okay? So there are a total of 204 changes. Now check out this next bit. We already saw this, but we're going to look at it again. You to ye. Changes where you have a ye changed to a you. There are six of them. That's 2.9%. Of all of the 204 changes, only six of them are changes where the text originally had ye, and then it's changed to what? You. That's six changes for 2.9% of the changes. Okay? Now look at you to ye. You to ye is 198 changes. 97% of the changes of the 204 that are made are a change from a you to a ye. Okay? These numbers gleaned from Vance reflect changes cataloged in the flagship folio editions, but do not reflect any changes that might have occurred in the lesser, smaller sized editions. Note also that the vast majority did not occur until the 18th century, under the editorship of Paris, 1762, and Blaney, 1769. So that means, are there almost 200 changes that are made in the use of you and ye over 150 years after the translation originally appeared? Okay? What's that?
Word for word, though.
Yeah, but it's word for word. Don't worry, guys. Genesis 2, well, before concluding this lesson, I would like to revisit our second case study of UE changes from lesson 252 regarding Genesis 9:4. Okay? So in the case of Genesis 9:4, Dr. Vance records a change from U to Ye occurring in the 1762 Cambridge Folio Edition, 8-11-42. Unfortunately, this is yet another example of oversight being made by consulting only the flagship folio editions. Please consider the following evidence. Okay, I'm going to go through this quick. Okay, notice that the 1602 bishops, which is the base text, how does it read here? Shall ye not eat? It's ye. Okay, you guys can look at all the details. I'm just going for the 1,000-foot view at the moment. Okay, here's the 1611. Shall you not eat? So the King James translators changed the bishops ye to you in the 1611.
Yes.
Okay? We're not going to look at the rest of those. Okay? Go to the Cambridge Folio 1762. Notice, shall ye not eat? So does Paris in 1762 reinstate the ye? Is everybody following me? Okay? So, according to Dr. Vance, the original bishop's reading of ye was reinstated by F.S. Paris in 1762. Unfortunately, this is not correct, since the 1683 Cambridge Quarto edition, H780, had already changed U to E in Genesis 9:4 nearly 80 years earlier. So look out my screenshot. This is the 1683 Cambridge Quarto, H780, and notice what it has. Ye. So had that change been made 80 years before Paris? Yes, it has. Objectively so. Okay? So let's look at the next part. Next point. Recall from above that 193, or 94.6% of the 204 U-Ye changes cataloged by Vance in Chapter 3 were ascribed to the 1762 and 1769 folio editions of Oxford and Cambridge, respectively. Of these 193 changes, my research uncovered that 132, or 68.3% of them, had already been made in the 1683 Cambridge Quarto edition, H780. 780. This is a staggeringly high number of edits that were not supposed to have been made until nearly 80 years later. Is everybody following that? Okay? This underscores a point that we have been making for a while now, since at least Lesson 250. The true printed history of the text is not limited to the flagship folio editions, as has been assumed by Norton, Campbell, and Vance. The real story unfolds year by year and printing by printing. Moreover, the 1683 Cambridge Quarto edition, H780, is a pivotal and massively undervalued edition in discerning the printed history of the text. And what this also means is that citation from earlier that I said was in gross error is absolutely, it's not even remotely true. Okay? So, for our purposes, the bottom line is this. The text that the readers of the AV use in the 21st century, i.e., the standard 1769 text, is not an identical match to the AV of 1611. Now, did we watch a video earlier in this lesson of a guy saying that it was? Did we? Thank you, Eli. Word for word. While these changes in the use of you and ye are not substantive, they indicate an edited text nonetheless. So will King James only preachers stand in pulpits today all across America and read from a Bible that has 204 changes in you ye? That's just in you ye. Okay? So we got a few minutes for a couple questions or comments. Anybody have anything for the good of the order here? Next week now, we will start looking at italics.
There's in the original Hebrew, is there a different Hebrew word for you and then me?
So I'm going to give you the best answer I can to the best of my ability. It has more to do with whether it's imperative or what the nature of the language is grammatically. So there's no the way I understand this is there's no different Hebrew word for a you versus a ye. Where the difference would come is when it's imperative and when it's not, and other technicalities of the grammar, which you're not going to know unless you know Hebrew and can look at the Hebrew text.
But even if there was, a lot of what they were doing was trying to make it sound good in English.
Correct.
Even though
so they were walking a balance between accuracy and fidelity to the text and the way it would sound when it's read out loud in English. Okay? Both of those were considerations. I would say their main consideration was fidelity to the text. Making it sound good in English was part what it was just, you know, sort of a nice outcome of it, but their main issue was fidelity and accuracy to the text. Okay? Alright, anybody else with a comment? Was there?
Sounds like to me that the scholars, from you to ye, or you to ye, they got fed up and they said, let's just leave it the way it's supposed to be. That's what it sounds like to me.
I think what they're trying to do is implement a standard rule in the text. That's why they're changing the stuff. Okay. So, any other questions in house? Was there any scuttlebutt online? No? Yeah, I know. That's a whole other topic. I'm not going to take the bait and get into that. So, anybody else have a question in here? Okay, if there are no questions, we'll conclude. Next Sunday when we meet, we'll